Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Monday, March the 25th, 2024. Yesterday, I did an interesting show, our weekly report on tech with my old friend Keith Teer, the author of That Was the Week newsletter. And we talked about how perhaps big tech might be getting even bigger. We discussed the news that Microsoft now seems to have acquired Inflection AI, one of the billion-dollar AI startups, and appointed the CEO and co-founder of Inflection AI, Mustafa Suleiman, who was also a co-founder of DeepMind, as their head of AI. Mustafa Suleiman was on the show last year as an interesting book. A lot of people are talking about how big tech is winning the AI talent war. The Financial Times has a piece on this. And it perhaps suggests, and Keith and I talked about this yesterday, that the old startup world no longer exists, that big tech is no different from big pharma or the large armament industry or biotech, and that the idea of a couple of guys in a garage a la Sergey Brin and Larry Page is no longer realistic. One man who's given a great deal of thought to that is a professor of business in New Orleans at Tulane University, the Freeman School of Business, Rob Laca. He was a State Department guy, and now he teaches the practice of innovation. And he has a new book out, it's out next month, The Venture Alchemists, How Big Tech Turned Profits into Power. And he spent a lot of time thinking about startup culture, particularly in Silicon Valley. He's joining us from New Orleans, where I was at the weekend. Rob, what do you make of this thesis that the startup days of big tech no longer really exist, that there won't be any real Googles of the future because the Googles and the Microsofts and the Apples are essentially now so dominant that there won't be a new round of startups?
Well, Andrew, thanks for having me on. I do think that one of the real concerns is that these large companies, these conglomerates, they are not startups. We think of them as fast-moving, innovative companies, but they are the corporate behemoths of our day. And when I think about why does that matter, well, it's because if we don't take the time to understand their startup days and what their original intentions were, which is what my book does, we may not fully understand what they've become. And my book argues that we see them as these scrappy little startups that are just trying to solve problems, when in reality, they're large conglomerates that have captured power. And that's not just power in the corporate world, in the marketplace, it's also power in politics. And so, I'm looking forward to talking about the book because it really has been quite a journey in terms of researching this stuff and trying to delve into what it means for us.
But surely, Rob, in the beginning, and use an example, Google, the couple of grad students at Stanford who co-founded Google, Brin and Page, they weren't thinking of their company as a corporate behemoth. They were classic startup guys. They didn't even know they were doing a startup. The original Google project was something they did in graduate school. So I don't quite understand your thesis. And the same can be true, I guess, of Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak at Apple and many other of the founders in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so chapter two, I go into the founding story of before it was Alphabet, it was Google. Before it was Google, it was Backrub. And the question is, what were Sergey and Larry thinking? What were they talking about when they were at Stanford? And if you go back and read their original Stanford thesis, it's eye-opening because these folks were anti-corporate. I mean, they were literally writing about the insidious business that Yahoo was undertaking. The black art was another phrase they used, of corporate deception. And they wanted to move search back to the academic realm. They wanted to, and they're decrying the fact that there are so many .coms compared to so many .edus at that stage of the development of the internet. And when we start to understand what their original intention was and then what got changed over time, I mean, these guys are centibillionaires now, $100 billion each to their names. But early on, they were warning about corporate deception and saying that there should never be advertisements alongside of organic search results because that would be evil. And what you learn is that that's where the don't be evil motto comes from, because they realized they couldn't possibly do good if they were, giving you results that were the corporate interests, not necessarily what the organic results would be. And so they committed themselves to at least not be evil rather than trying to advance the truth and pursue that as a independent good in and of itself. And so you go to those origin stories, you learn a lot from who these people were and what their intentions were, at least.
But this observation has been made, Rob, many times before. I mean, they were a couple of idealists, everyone knew they were, and then they hit the reality of venture capital and the reality of making a profit as a startup. What is your point? Did they become evil themselves? I'm not clear on your argument.
No, I wouldn't judge them as that. My point is more that it's important to remember where they came from and sort of shed light on who they once were and just be curious about it. I mean, I think we've, at least for me, many of my students have forgotten or never knew the stories of the early version of Google or the early version of Facebook at FaceMash or any of these others. And so I think the real question is, if we go and learn from these folks when they were just normal students, kids who were trying to figure this stuff out, what lessons does that lead us to sort of, what new conclusions could we come to about what sort of businesses we should be building today, especially in an era of AI, as you had mentioned earlier. And so I'm not trying to judge anybody. I do think the more important thing is really trying to understand where they came from and where they're going. I mean, the Google guys literally didn't have a company when they got the first check, $100,000 check made out to Google Inc. And instead of going to the bank, setting up an account and depositing that check, they went to Burning Man instead. And that was actually the first Google doodle, was the Burning Man. Burning Man was sort of the background of Google as an out of office message to say, hey, we're not going to be fixing any problems that arise with this platform in the next week because we're off at Burning Man. And so that's what the book tries to accomplish in the early chapters, is really retelling those early stories. So I go through Facebook, Google, Uber.
I know some of these people. I certainly knew Travis Kalanick early on. He was always rather hard-headed. I don't see there being much in common between Travis Kalanick and Sergey Brin or Larry Page, who were idealists. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's Zuckerberg, who perhaps once was an idealist in terms of networking the world. Now he seems increasingly hard-headed. So what's the thesis in the book? Are these people who have been corrupted by money? That's some critique of Google. Although even the two founders of Google are quite different. It seems as if Sergey Brin is still somewhat of an idealist, whereas Page is slightly different. Are you suggesting that these people were corrupted by the profitability of their businesses?
No, I'm suggesting that they're just human. And that's the revelation for me in trying to really delve into their stories. And again, I wrote this book for my students so that they would understand that these are not superhuman entrepreneurs that were out to fulfill some destiny that was predetermined. These were just real people who were making real choices. And some of them struggled with those decisions, and they felt those ethical lines that they didn't want to cross and maybe did anyways. There were trade-offs that they made. And some of them set out to create platforms that they knew would be dangerous and did it anyways. I mean, one quote that I had never heard until I really delved into the research, but that really opened my eyes, is one from Peter Thiel, who, again, the earliest investor in Facebook. He'd warned in 2004 that, quote, the pride of a price of abandoning oneself to such an artificial representation is always too high, because decisions that are avoided are always too important. By making people forget that they have souls, the Antichrist will succeed in swindling people out of them. So Thiel wrote that in 2004. I hadn't seen it quoted anywhere else until I delved into this research and was studying this stuff myself. And that made me pause and say, wow, this is what he's thinking in 2004, while Mark Zuckerberg is creating a platform that literally is built to encourage judgment as entertainment. It's pretty surprising. And so that's what
Thiel, of course, was one of the co-founders of PayPal. And there was a so-called PayPal mafia, Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman in particular, others. It doesn't seem as though, I mean, Thiel is an intellectual, conservative intellectual, is not much liked by progressives. Hoffman is a progressive and one of the big funders of the Democratic Party. And Musk is just Musk. Can one really make generalizations about Musk, Thiel, and Hoffman?
No, I don't think you can make generalizations, but I think you can garner really interesting insights if you delve deeply in their stories. And that's what I hope to do with the book. And so, I mean, this is a deeply researched book. I have over 1,900 citations, and I've gone in deep on not only the documents that are public, like Peter Thiel and David Sachs wrote a book called The Diversity Myth in 1995, where they're criticizing Stanford for, frankly, a number of the controversies that still continue today about what should be taught and what should be allowed to be said and what should not, what should be censored. I mean, this is a lot of what they were discussing in even 95 in that book, which again is publicly known. But then I also went to the Stanford archives and went in pretty deep to try and understand who these people were, what they were thinking. I went through all of the early Stanford Review, which was the paper that they had founded as sort of an alternative to the Stanford Daily. And I looked at what others at Stanford were saying in the Stanford Daily at that same time. It's pretty eye-opening. I mean, if you're thinking about cancel culture and whether that is actually a full force in the world, the things these people were saying back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Rob, I'm not entirely clear what you're saying. Peter Thiel and Sachs wrote Diversity Myth. They were always conservatives at Stanford. But Hoffman was on the other side. I mean, not all startup entrepreneurs are hardcore free market conservatives like Thiel and Sachs, are they?
No, that's not the generalization that I would make. What I would say is that it's interesting to me. I'm sort of curious about the fact that Thiel and Sachs and the Diversity Myth criticize a church group for protesting apartheid in South Africa. They defend someone who ends up admitting to raping somebody. His name was Stuart Thomas, who was 23 years old, and he ended up raping a freshman at Stanford. And, you know, that is fully documented. It's in the Stanford Daily News, and it's fully documented from the Diversity Myth. I mean, these are people that you would think would be quote-unquote canceled based upon what happens in terms of the way that the world works, but these are people who have gained power and sat on boards and been very pretty influential in the world. And so I think the point is not to generalize, the point is to deeply understand what happens when we live in a world where that sort of power can be gained and wielded. And especially when you think about what it means in terms of the way that the rest of the world plays out in terms of big tech. And so that's my hope, is that I really do want to shed light on the real history that is here and do that in a way, like I said, that's deeply researched and hopefully, you know, start some conversations. I don't have all the answers by far. I have a few questions and a lot of interesting insights, I hope.
You said you wrote your book for your students at the business school, but what does the example of Sachs and Thiel's Diversity Myth tell them? I mean, they're all training to be business people. Are you suggesting to them that they don't support rapists? I mean, it seems a little odd that most startup entrepreneurs, for better or worse, don't share the politics of Thiel and Sachs.
No, I think the more important questions that are raised are, what do you learn from what these people were doing and saying. I mean, I think there is a connection to be made from the fact that with PayPal, that they were able to figure out fraud and sort of detection of outlier behavior, because they were the outliers on Stanford's more liberal campus. And that was part of what was informing the way that they were thinking. And so that's not only the case with Thiel and Sachs, but it's also with Keith Raboy, who becomes the lead for community outreach at PayPal after he yells anti-gay slurs and is, there's an entire sort of campus controversy that happens around that. And again, that's in the diversity myth, the book, but it's also, you have the provost at the time, who was Condoleezza Rice, speaking out against him in that moment. And so I think knowing those histories more fully, it's not only really interesting, and it sort of is worth spending the time with to know who these people were and what they were saying and doing. It's also important for us to, in an era where we feel like everything is seen and known, to know that these stories haven't all been told in a full way. And then also when you think about not only PayPal with the fraud detection and the outlier behavior, but you think about many of these same folks were involved with Palantir. And so Palantir, again, was a company that Thiel had started that was all about finding outlier behavior in data. And then you think about the way that that's used, where my argument is that outliers can be organizers. They realize that people who say extreme things or do extreme things can actually become organizers. And knowing that is part of what Palantir is all about in terms of finding gangs and cartels and terrorist cells. All of that is what Palantir is so powerful at doing. I argue that part of that comes from who these people were, what they were saying and doing, that goes back to the 80s and 90s.
What about the counter models, though, to Thiel and to Sachs? Craig Newmark, for example, who's funded a lot of progressive initiatives, the founder, of course, of Craigslist, or as I said, Reid Hoffman, or many others in Silicon Valley who have been increasingly supportive of progressive movements. Are you saying in the book, in terms of your research, that big tech is reactionary? Is that the conclusion you've drawn from your research?
No, not at all. I would say that the big tech has gained power. And when we think of big tech, we often think of the money they've made. We think of venture capitalists, and we focus on the capital, the money that they have, and the way that they've profited. And we often sort of glamorize it. We think of them as people who've been on this odyssey out to fulfill some destiny, this hero's myth. And it's not about the adventure. It's not even about the capital. For me, it's also about the power they've gained and wielded. And that's both sides. I mean, that is both Democrats and Republicans. It's conservatives and liberals that are all involved with this. Look no further than David Plouffe, who was Obama's campaign manager and then worked at the White House and then went off to go work at Uber and was helping them to strike a deal with the Saudis. And so I think you look at these stories and it doesn't take long to realize that these people are wielding power. And it's not a left or right. It's not a partisan discussion. It's often a conversation more about how power gets wielded in America.
And what about the thesis many people have put forward that many of these tech entrepreneurs, Gates is the best example, spent half their life making money and then half their life giving their money away. Another one who comes to mind is Pierre Omidyar, who was one of the co-founders of eBay, made a lot of money at eBay and then put a lot of money into progressive journalism. Of course, Gates is iconic as a philanthropist. Is this a positive model you want to teach to your students? If someone came to your office hours and said, I want to be like Bill Gates, I want to spend half my life making massive amounts of money and then half my life giving it away, how would you respond? And what does your book suggest about those kinds of examples?
Sure. I think that the most interesting part of that question is around, are you trying to gain money to then wield power? Or are you trying to gain money to then gain power to then protect your money and your prestige? And I don't have an easy answer for that for any of my students. I want them to live the life that's most fulfilling to them and most purposeful to them. But I think it is important for all of us as Americans to understand that that this is what is happening in American democracy. And so, you know, going back to Thiel, I think it's important for people to realize how much he funded J.D. Vance's campaign, Blake Masters's campaign, and how important he's been for both of their careers. And I trace that in the book. I mean, I trace the ways, especially in Vance's career, that he supported someone who was so anti-Trump and who literally made his name. He changed his name from J.D. Hamill to J.D. Vance when he got married after 2 years before he wrote Hillbilly Elegy, or before it was published, and after he graduated from Yale Law School. And he then ends up being a never-Trumper and espouses that view pretty adamantly, and then completely reverts on that, and with Thiel's money through his super PAC is able to go from last to first in the Republican primary, and then win his election. He's a U.S. senator. And so I think those trends are most important for us as we're thinking through what does it mean for all of us as citizens, and then especially for my students who want to create great companies. That's what matters in terms of knowing what you're up against in terms of trying to build a company that's able to compete in this environment.
We're speaking with Rob Lalka, the author of The Venture Alchemist. It's out next week. Interesting new book, thesis on power and profitability, how big tech turned profits into power. I want to remind everyone, when it comes to profits and power, keen on, thanks Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for allowing us to have such great guests as Rob Lalka on the show. I'm going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Rob to talk more about profits and power in Silicon Valley after the break. So don't go away, anyone.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Rob Lalka, the author of The Venture Alchemist. So Rob, before the break, we were talking, or you were talking about Peter Thiel helping J.D. Vance get into Congress, maybe even one day become president. Isn't that the American model, though? You make a lot of money, for better or worse, and then you choose to pursue your own power, ideological agenda, or just general enjoyment by investing in politics. It's not necessarily a right-wing thing. As I said, Reid Hoffman, who was Thiel, one of Thiel's colleagues at PayPal, very close friends, they were at Stanford together. He's a major funder of the Democratic Party. So what's the difference between Hoffman and Thiel? And isn't the American way making lots of money and then investing in the public sphere? And isn't the Thiel model, I personally, I'm not a great fan of his politics, but isn't that a better model than the Larry Ellison model, the Oracle founder, of just spending money on yachts and young wives?
I mean, I think the best model in America is actually what matters to all of us as citizens, and having a fair say in our democracy that isn't overruled by oligarchs. And, you know, I worry about the future of American democracy, especially in an era where, in one of the lines that I use in the book, is that we're in a time where the average American is dying sooner while the richest amongst us try to live forever. And I worry about where we are focusing our time, which is in this sort of warring tribes mentality that you're espousing there. It is scary to me. It's Democrat versus Republican in election year. It's going to get worse. In the book, one of the lines I use, it feels like twin Cains trying to always murder each other. And I think we miss the point, which is that this isn't about liberal or conservative. This isn't about Democrat or Republican. This isn't about Hoffman or Thiel. It's about real human beings that are making real choices that make it so that the rest of us don't fully understand the power they're wielding and the way in which that takes power away from the rest of us. And so that's my hope, is that if people read this book, they start to understand the way that power is being wielded and the way that money is working in our politics, and the way that it's influencing even the basics, like what we see through the feeds in our phones. And that hopefully will encourage more of a lowercase d democratic dialogue that happens in a way that's very much in person and old school, in town halls and knocking on doors and all of the other good stuff that makes democracy great.
Is this, Rob, a political problem or a problem of Silicon Valley? I mean, a lot of the issues you're talking about and money and politics got nothing to do with Silicon Valley. Sure, the entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley make a lot of money and then some of them siphon it into politics, but they're certainly not the first to do that. Are you suggesting that the reforms in America need to be at the structural level of taking money out of politics? Are you suggesting that the state should aggressively regulate big companies? One of the big stories last week was the attempt to regulate Apple, a major antitrust case against Apple. Of course, there's a lot of antitrust cases now going on against Google and many other cases against Facebook. What is the fix to the problem that you're observing in your book?
I mean, I think all of us, unfortunately, don't give credit enough to quote unquote ordinary people. And that's part of what I talk about in the book, is that I want ordinary people to be recentered in this conversation. I actually go back and I interview the folks who had the early warnings about Facebook in particular, but also many social media companies and many of these sort of early big tech as they were emerging. I go back and I interview them because they were warning about some of these concerns in college newspapers in 2004, 2005, 2006. And I was able to find these people. I interviewed them, and that's actually how I end the book, is I asked them, what would you do if you could change things? Some really illuminating perspectives that come from that. And I think that that's an important place to go to try and find answers. I don't have all of the answers in terms of what we should do in terms of regulation or in terms of trying to get money out of politics. I do think that the more that we can trust in normal people, ordinary Americans, to be able to come up with answers, the better off we'll be. And I think that a lot of folks doubt the intellect and the curiosity and the decency of most of America. And I think that that's part of my book, is really trying to say, you know what, these people who have gained so much power shouldn't be the topic of conversation so much. We should learn about how human they are, how flawed they are, and then we should try and understand what it's done to our world, and then take some of that control back.
As I said at the beginning, you teach at the business school at Tulane. You're a professor of practice. And the kind of thesis and some of the things you're saying, I've heard many times before, but they tend to come from people in philosophy, history, literature departments. How does your thesis go down in the business school? You sound to me as if you're just anti-business, because the reality is, for better or worse, business creates wealth. Business creates the very profitability that you seem to have such contempt for in some ways. Where's the business school angle here, Rob?
Now, contempt's the wrong word. I would say curiosity. Really, it's just an interesting thing to observe. And very much the tone of the book is I'm hoping to shed more light than heat. And that's very much the tone I take, is I raise questions. And I think it's important to raise questions about the role of business in society. I'm very pro-technology. I'm very pro-business. And I think we can just do it better in a way in which we approach some of these questions in ways that more people understand them and more people have agency. And so, for instance, one of the topics I bring up is, when you think about how many times people read terms of service agreements that they have no idea what they're signing up for, we're essentially data illiterate. We don't understand what we're signing up for and what it means for all of us. If ordinary people actually understood how valuable data was and had more agency in that, I think that's a profound thought. I think it's a profound way for us each to consider what not only free enterprise would look like and free markets would look like, where big tech maybe had less control and ordinary people had more control, we might actually be able to talk about free and fair markets, free and fair enterprise, adding fairness back into that. And that's very American. I mean, it's not liberty for all, it's liberty and justice for all. And when we think about the future of what this country needs to be, I do think that bringing fairness and justice back into the conversation is well worth doing.
You're talking to me from New Orleans. I'm in San Francisco on the edge of Silicon Valley, where, of course, much of the wealth and power is concentrated. You've done some thinking and work, writing on innovation in Louisiana, in New Orleans. Is that one of the problems? You also wrote an interesting piece in Fortune on opportunity zones. Is one of the fixes to the problems you're observing distributing wealth and power more equally throughout the 50 states, and rather than just concentrating it mostly in Northern California?
Yeah, I mean, in the opening of the book, I actually begin with my acknowledgments, because I think it helps to sort of set the stage for what this book is all about. One of the things I acknowledge is I think that New Orleans is the only place I could have written this book. And part of that's because New Orleans is a place that does ask questions. We're curious people. We are, in general, pretty creative and pretty collaborative, and we care about those around us. We care about community here. And it's, if you visit New Orleans, it's easy to understand what that means for what this place is all about. And so, you know, I do think that New Orleans has played a particular role in how I wrote this book and how I approached the research. But I also do think that there's something to be said for the fact that, you know, Silicon Valley, and then even the role that Silicon Valley has played in influencing the way that decisions are made in Washington, D.C., I think it's important for us all to understand, because it influences the way that all of our lives are lived here in America, not just in those two particular places. And so my hope is that more people will read this book and become curious about these stories and delve in deep. And that doesn't mean just reading the book itself. It may mean looking at the endnotes and saying, wow, I want to go learn more about that particular story. And that's part of why I published with Columbia University Press, is so this book would be peer reviewed. It would go through their full editorial review process. It would be deeply researched. And then you would have all of those endnotes to be able to delve in more deeply.
Final question, Rob. You've mentioned, and I'm quoting you here, ordinary people. These are the people you want to have, I guess, power or more influence. I'm not entirely sure what an ordinary person is, but are you suggesting that ordinary people should or shouldn't become entrepreneurs? Because after all, the only way to fight power is with power. The only way to challenge the massive profitability of companies like Google and Facebook is through equally profitable companies. Is one of the arguments in your book is, and again, I'm a little uncomfortable with this term, but you're the one who used it, ordinary people. Should ordinary people go to business school and become entrepreneurs?
Yeah, every time I use the word ordinary, it's meant in a way that's to uplift. And I actually do call out the people who use phrases like J.D. Vance did, of quote unquote underclass, which is what he referred to people who were supporting Donald Trump in 2016 when he was writing about them. I think terms like that are really detrimental and really condescending. Every time I use ordinary, it's meant to uplift and meant to really celebrate that there are amazing people all across this country that are creating great businesses that frankly don't have access to the resources and the opportunities that some of the people in this book did. And they may not if they continue, if things continue as they are. And so, for instance, every time Uber calls somebody who's an Uber driver an entrepreneur or a small business owner, I want people to think twice about that, because when we look at who actually benefits from that work, that labor, often it is the corporation. And one of the largest shareholders there, of course, is the Saudis, as I mentioned earlier, because of the deal that was struck by David Plouffe. And so I think understanding that more thoroughly and really questioning that, that's what this book is all about. It really is trying to understand what has happened through big tech's capture of so much wealth and power, and then what does it mean for the rest of us?